The scene, that's 1600 years ago, in the city of Nahar Da'an Babel. A significant Talmud Chacham, great Talmud Chacham, simple man, great Talmud Chacham, walking through town, and he's arrested. His crime, his shoes. Sounds like the fashion police have arrested him. But the truth is, this is not fantasy. This is a Gemara in Bava Kamma. Gemara in Bava Kamma starts very Bava in the Testament, and Alpha goes on to the balance of the stories on the Testament days. The Gemara tells about a great Talmud Chacham was also an unusually humble person. His name was Eliezer Zeira, Eliezer HaKatan. He was probably called HaKatan because he was a great Anav. And he was walking through the streets of Nahar Da, and Gemara says he's walking through the streets of Nahar Da, and he's wearing black shoes. Wearing black shoes. And the police, but it was the Jewish police. At that period in Jewish history, Jews had a semi-autonomous sovereignty within the Persian Empire, and the Reish Galusa was the political head of the Jewish community, and he had authority over the Jewish community in Bavel. And they would see to it that halacha and midos were apparently at this different Reish Galusa at different standards. But at the period in which Eliezer Zeira lives, the Reish Galusa was imposing the rule of halachic law, and he said, so his policemen come over to him, to Eliezer Zeira, and they say, why are you wearing the black shoes for? Violation, apparently, as Rav Chaim Friedland points out, violation of tznius. It wasn't apparently a typical way to see from elsewhere. Shas also was not typical, perhaps, a Jewish dress. So what's this all about? So he explains to them, the black shoes are a sign of avelus over Yerushalayim. Certainly a theme that's on our mind today. So they say to him, you think, at chashivas l'sabul Yerushalayim, you think that you're chashiv enough to be misabel over Yerushalayim, to mourn over Yerushalayim? Who do you think you are? They said, he was arrested, get this, Eliezer Zeira was arrested for the sin of arrogance. They said, you think you're showing off as though you're some great Talmud Chacham, that you're worthy to publicly mourn over Yerushalayim. What do you think you are? So he was going to be arrested. Strange story. He's going to be arrested by the Jewish police for the sin of arrogance, for showing off as though he's a great Talmud Chacham, that he's entitled to mourn over Yerushalayim. And then the Gemara goes on to say that he tells him, you understand, I didn't want to tell you, but I actually am... I have what it takes. I actually am a Talmud Chacham, and I'm qualified. They say, well, prove it. And so the scene becomes more and more almost absurd. As the police give Eliezer Zeira Bechina to see whether he's talking. And then when he passes the Bechina, they say, oh, you're talking Talmud Chacham? Okay, you have the right to be Misabel over Yerushalayim. That's the story of a common untes. So it's certainly a striking story on many levels. Sort of the notion that a Jew could be arrested for being a Balgaiva is a fascinating idea, but let's dig in a little more. Okay, so Eliezer Zeira was a Talmud Chacham and also none of a humble person. They didn't realize that he was a great man. He seemed like a very simple person. So they said you're showing off as though you're a great Torah scholar. Who do you think you are to publicly mourn over Yerushalayim? Let's just dive into that angle, because that really takes us back, especially on Shavuot Sivatamos, or the 18th of Tammuz, to be precise. But the day we begin 3 weeks of public mourning over Yerushalayim. So last we checked, it's a good thing to mourn over Yerushalayim. Last we checked, there's a series of simanim and Shulchan Aruch that detail exactly how we mourn for Yerushalayim all year long to a lesser extent. Chas is a little bit different. Remember, Churban Yerushalayim, different. A Jew builds a house. He leaves, if a Jew builds a house or paints a house, so he's going to leave a square opposite the door, unpainted, to remember that our simcha is not complete, our home is not complete, we don't have the ultimate home of Ribono Shel'olam. All year long, there are little bits and pieces in our lives that remind us of that we're missing Yerushalayim, we're missing Beis HaMikdash. And certainly, 3 weeks, 9 days, Shavuot Sivatamos, Tisha B'Av. Being misabel to Yerushalayim, we always assumed was a good thing. I mean, tragic that we need to, but the appropriate thing to do. And you certainly don't have to be a great Talmud Chacham to fast in Tisha B'Av. The benefits is not announced, but if you're a great Talmud Chacham, so you should fast today. But if you're not such a big Talmud Chacham, so then you shouldn't fast in Tisha B'Av. That's not what he said. He said if you're not healthy, then you shouldn't, but anyone who's healthy should. So what's the premise of this Gemara? Arrested? It's gaiva? It's arrogant to be Mesabu Yishalayim? So what does that mean for us? So Reb Chaim Friedlander was a mashgiach in a number of different yeshivas across Eretz Yisrael for over many decades, and finally for longest I think stretch of time, is mashgiach in Panavish. A fascinating thinker, a fascinating Baal Machshava. I highly recommend if you're looking for relatively accessible, easy to read essays on the Machshava, the thought behind different Yom Tovim. The three volumes of Sussei Chaim and Yom Tovim. There's another topic. It's also very beautiful. And he gives what I think is a very important, valuable, and practical insight for us, for now, for Shavuos Batamas, and for the 3 weeks which have just begun, and for how to make the most of this very potentially productive time, an insight rooted in this Gemara. And let's get to it by talking about climate. So everyone knows, if you take in earth science, or if you've ever looked at a map, so you know that not all parts of the globe have the same temperature, not all parts of the globe have the same climate. Some of you maybe come from places where it snows for much of the year, or where it's very windy, and it's a lot cooler than it is here. And you know that you walk around Beit Meir, you don't have to be an expert botanist to notice walking on Beit Meir that there are species growing here that may not grow in your hometown, depending on where you come from. If you come from north of the Mason-Dixon line, so you probably don't have palm trees or pomegranate trees or fig trees growing in your home state. Right? Different parts of the world have different climates. Different animals and different plants belong in different places. You're not going to find a polar bear walking around Beit Meir, and you're not going to find iguanas north of the Arctic Circle. Different parts of the world have different climates. And different parts of the world have different climates which lend themselves to different flora and fauna, to a different array of plants and animals. The Sefer HaKuzari, written by Yehuda Levi almost 1,000 years ago, one of the classic works, one of the earliest of the Rishonim on Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy. So he points out that just as the different parts of the world have different physical climates that allow for different biodiversity, different parts of the world also have different spiritual climates. And different parts will lend themselves more easily to different spiritual pursuits. And he goes on to talk specifically about Eretz Yisrael and what Eretz Yisrael, there are things that may, gains one can make, sorts of growth one could achieve anywhere in the world, but perhaps the metaphysical, the spiritual climate of Eretz Yisrael makes it easier to achieve those things here. Now what's true for place, the different places in the world have different spiritual climates, is also true for time. And this is something that I've sort of come across this idea, but let's sort of maybe in a hazy way, let's say clearly. Different times in the Jewish calendar, we understand that time moves in one direction, time moves forward, but not just in a straight line. Our Masorah is that time is sort of like an upward spiral. That you're a year older than you were before, than you were a year ago, and you're 5 years older than you were 5 years ago. But at the same time, you come around again to Pesach, hopefully you're further up, certainly chronologically a year older, and hopefully you've grown further, another year under your belt, but you come around to a higher point, but you're back, it's like an upward spiral, you're back again to Pesach. And there's something about Chodesh Nisan that recurs every year. And there's something about Chodesh Iyar that recurs every year. There's something about Chodesh El that recurs every year. Every year it's a new year, and you're in a different place, but at the same time, that spiritual climate, not a climate of place, but a climate of time. Different times in the Jewish calendar have different spiritual climates that allow, not for different plants and animals, but for different types of, gives us greater potential for different types of spiritual gain, different types of spiritual growth at different times of the year. And that says, maybe you heard the term skula. This time is mesugal. What does that mean? That means this idea. It's another way of packaging the same idea that the spiritual climate of this day, of this week, of this month of the year allows itself, has a tendency to allow, to cultivate greater growth in whatever area it is than some other time of the year. So Chodesh Nisan, Pesach, allows for a certain type of growth in Muna, Sukkot, perhaps differently, and El, and so on and so forth. So Reb Chaim Friedlander points out that He has a remarkable quote from Rabbi Saul Salanta, a friend of the Muslim movement, who talks about Tisha B'Av being a day for potentially as great growth as Yom Kippur, or being in a different direction. You just don't think of Tisha B'Av, at least for those who have not yet been an NC Sarkola for Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a sad day, Tisha B'Av is a serious day, a somber day. A day of growth, it takes strikes us as a little bit surprising. Mirtz Hashem, in 3 weeks from now, they will be dancing in a renewed Beis HaMikdash. We'll be sitting here experiencing, hopefully, for those of you from this is your first summer here, a Tisha B'Av like probably none you've ever experienced before. It is a day of great growth. And what is that great growth? What is it that Tisha B'Av is mesugal for? So Rav Chaim Friedlander suggests that maybe the key lies, the beginning of understanding what to do with this period of time lies in that Gemara. Because he suggests that, yes, all Jews are supposed to be mesabel over Yerushalayim for 3 weeks a year. It's only a rare tzaddik who can be mesabel for Yerushalayim in a meaningful way on in Chodesh Tevis, in Chodesh Shvat, in Chodesh Adar. That takes an unusual level. And why? So to take another reality that we've become more familiar with having come to Beit Meir, your phone. Does it work? Or doesn't it work? Can you make the call? Can you not make the call? You're trying to download a file, and you're not sure if it's just taking endless time because you have little reception, and you have no reception. Every spot, or you're one of those guys who fancy you walk out onto the ledge outside Beis Meir, you're just the right spot to hold your phone at just the right angle. We've all been there. Right? You get good reception, bad reception, where are you? And here's the thing. If you're on the phone with someone in Beit Meir, and the conversation gets a little touchy, and suddenly the line goes dead, did he hang up on you because he got upset? And instead of communicating, he just passive-aggressively hung up on you? Or did you just move into a dead spot and the call got dropped? It's hard to know. I don't have good reception. If I'm in a place with crystal clear reception and the call suddenly ends, you know that he hung up. If you're in a place with bad radio reception and you turn to your favorite station and there's nothing going on, did they stop broadcasting or you're just not able to pick up the signal? But if you're in a place with great crystal clear reception and that one channel is just blank, you know that they're no longer broadcasting. For 3 weeks, Tisha B'Av in particular, but the whole period that begins with Shiva Asar B'Tam is today, is that time when ironically our reception is clearer. We are in a certain sense more tuned into Ribono Shel'Olam over the next couple of weeks, such that we can actually notice what it is that we're missing. Because what does it mean to be? Let's break it down a little bit. To mourn over Yerushalayim. Mourning for what? What are you mourning for? Mourning over a Beis HaMikdash that we never saw. It's going to take time. It's going to take work to try to figure out what are we missing. Rachman Litzlan. A Jew loses a close relative. He is at Shiva. Some of you perhaps have seen this in your own families, unfortunately, or you've heard about this, you've learned about this. The first week after that follows the burial is very intense Avelis of Shiva, 7 days. And then it notches down a little bit for the remainder of Shloshim, the 30 days following the burial. And finally, if it's for a parent, there's an even lesser, less intense degree of Avelis that stretches throughout Yud Beis Chodesh throughout the first 12 months after the parent's passing. But it starts very intensely and slowly works its way down. Now, the reverse. You start with 3 weeks, and then 9 days, and then Tisha B'Av, because Ramban comments in a Sefer classic on Avelos, Taras Adam, Avelos Chadasha, a new, fresh loss of a family member, you naturally feel it. You don't need to be taught to notice that there's a gap, that something was torn away from my heart. So I feel it intensely. Over time, one can slowly begin to heal the grieve and heal somewhat, and that Avelos slowly lessens and tapers. Avelos Yeshana, old Avelos, which is us, we're trying to morph for something that happened a long time ago. That's something that needs building. It's not going to come automatically. For you and I, for Eliezer Ze'ira, a great tzaddik who was so incredibly intimate with Ribono Shel'Olam and felt every day what could have been even closer. So he felt it all the time. So for a man of his stature, it made a lot of sense to wear the black shoes, to do whatever he was doing, to demonstrate the Aviz Rishlaim every day of the year. But for you and I, men of more moderate stature, so it's not going to come as naturally. But it's something that we're more attuned to starting today, starting last night. For the coming 3 weeks, we're going to be on a higher madriga. And we can be Eliezer Ze'ira for the next 3 weeks. For the next 3 weeks, that's the school of the time, is that we're more tuned into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now is when we have left the Beit Meir style cell phone reception. Now is when we get clear for the next 3 weeks, we have crystal clear reception. So that ironically, we're closer to Ribbono Shlom in a way that we'll notice more what we're missing. Whereas all year long, maybe there's so much static in our lives that for you and I can't speak for you, if I speak for myself, I don't know, the end of Chodesh Adar, am I so tuned into Ribbono Shlom that I notice, you know, we could be so much closer if we had a Beis HaMikdash? There's so much static. There's so much background noise in my life. It's hard to know. Ribbono Shlom is not broadcasting as much because no Beis HaMikdash, or just, you know, there's too much static. I can't tell what I'm missing. But today begins the 3 weeks when we're more, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us greater access to Him. The sort of greater access which will allow us to feel what it is that we're missing. This is powerful time. If that's true, as Reb Chaim Friedlander explained based on this Gemara in Bava Kamma, Daf and Tes, that it's these 3 weeks, and it's going to build, it's going to intensify, a closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when we can all be in Eliezer Ze'ir, and we can all feel build close to Ribbono Shel Olam so that we can know what we're missing, and what it is that we ought to be yearning for. So that's time, that's an opportunity not to miss. Carpe diem. Better seize these days and use them well. These are great gifts. Great gifts. So what are we going to do with them? What are we going to do with them? So if the channel is open and the channels are clear, there's a line that I've shared with some of you in the past, a great Yiddish line from the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, Yitzhak Huttner. Very dramatic personality. And one of the dominant Torah personalities in the United States, certainly in the New York area, in the early part of the post-war period. So he used to say, a Jew is at the end of it. He wrote a lot, spent a lot of time trying to understand the meaningfulness of the different Yom Tovim. And in many number of printed Svarim, of his ideas, his thoughts, Pachad Yitzchak, on the meaningfulness of different Yom Tovim. And he's said to have had this line that he would say to Talmidim sometimes, that at the end of a Yom Tov, when Pesach is on those last couple of hours of Pesach, about to go back to Chametz, when Shavuos is almost over, you're hitting Ne'ilah, when Purim is coming to an end. So the attitude has to be, as he put, Nisht, Nach Yom Tov Avek, nor Nach Yom Tov Arayin. The attitude can't be another Yom Tov gone by. It has to be another Yom Tov gone in. It can't be, Pesach was nice, and it's over. It was nice while it lasted, and then, you know, move on, but I'm the same person I was. Purim was great, it was a lot of fun, and I did a lot of mitzvahs, so I gave a lot of tzedakah, and we had a suda, we had a great time with friends, and we move on. It can't be that way. If it is that way, it's nice you did the mitzvahs, but you missed the opportunity. It can't just be a Yom Tov gone over my shoulder, here today, gone tomorrow, but it went through me. Yeah, it's no longer Pesach. It's now Chodesh Tammuz. But hopefully, with the goal, and again, you can't beat yourself up if it hasn't been this way. This is a long-term goal. This is what you want to grow into over the course of a decade, over the course of 3 decades. But the goal is to be the sort of Jew for whom Pesach goes through me. And it's no longer Pesach. I'm back to Yin Chametz, but I'm a different person than I was before. My emunah has deepened. I've changed. I've matured. I understand things more. I understand my relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Whatever the theme of the Yom Tov is, I get it more. I get it more, and I feel it more. And it's that blend of understanding and feeling, which is what the way one can prepare. If one prepares for a Yom Tov, not only through buying matzah and buying lulav and helping out at home, which are all incredibly important, in addition to helping out at home, you also want to carve out time to prepare mentally, spiritually, emotionally, to learn, to intellectually prepare for the Yom Tov, to learn some of the ideas of the Yom Tov, and thereby be able to experience Yom Tov more deeply and come out with something, have grown, have deepened in some way. It's true for happy Yom Tovim, and it's true for sad times, but powerful times as well. So if we're going to take the 3 weeks seriously, if we're going to take Avelus over Yerushalayim as an opportunity, which we don't have all year long, to plug in, so now let's, with that in mind, so now let's spend a couple of minutes. The time we have now, so let's begin to learn. Let's begin to think of what are some of the ideas we need to understand Yerushalayim Beis HaMikdash more mature, to figure out what it is that we had and what it is that we're missing. If you'll indulge me, one more mashal before we jump in. Mashal is close to my heart. I apologize to those who have heard it in the past, but hopefully it bears repeating. This is a mashal that speaks to a lot of different growth opportunities. And I heard this mashal attributed to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva of Torah V'Das. He said that imagine a tzitzis party. We're not Hasidish, so we don't make upsharms for our kids. When they need a haircut, they get a haircut. The kid turns 3, he's way through our tzitzis, so you make a party. He's going to start a mitzvah. It's an important step in his chinuch, and you celebrate. A child should understand, even at a young age, that starting to do mitzvah is something of incredible value, something to take, which one should take incredible pride. And you imagine the scene. I don't know, how many of you have little brothers at home? No one has little brothers? Oh, okay. Okay. How many have such little brothers, you remember they were 3? Okay, that's pretty good. How many of you have older siblings who are married and you have nephews? Okay. So most of you are involved with one end or the other. So imagine the scene. You've either seen this or you can at least imagine the scene, especially if you have some experience. Imagine the scene. And the little 3-year-old kid gets up on the chair and they take out the puff, the little size 3 tzitzis with the puff paint mitzvah train or whatever, you know, whatever the picture is on the tzitzis. And the kid stands on the chair and you make a bracha, put on the tzitzis, everyone claps. You have a cake and everyone celebrates, and it's beautiful, and it is beautiful. It is beautiful. But if the kid is 13 or 23 or 53 or 93 and still wearing the size 3 tzitzis, which by now are choking around the neck, there's clearly nothing left to celebrate. Because it's obvious to us that the physical parts of our Avodas Hashem need to mature with us as we grow. The tzitzis have to get bigger as your body gets bigger. That's obvious. What's less obvious and less apparent, but actually far more important and far more true, is that the spiritual, the intellectual, the emotional aspects of our yadis, the ideas and the appreciation of ideas and the attitudes and the feelings need to grow with us as we grow. But unlike tzitzis, where you'll notice that you need a bigger size tzitzis, it's impossible to not notice, with the mental, intellectual, and emotional parts of yadis, it's easy, and let me explain what I mean. For those who have had the blessing of a yeshiva education from young age, the blessing some have enjoyed, others have not, and both tracks have positives and challenges. If you've had the blessing of being exposed to Torah concepts at a very young age, it's a great blessing, but it comes with a risk. And the risk is, if you met Avraham Avinu when you were 4 years old, if you met Moshe Rabbeinu when you were 5, if you met Shmona Esrei when you were 8, so you could easily, and by inertia, you naturally will, remain with a 4-year-old understanding of Arvinu for life, with a 5-year-old's understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu, with an 8-year-old's understanding of Shmona Esrei, because you just sort of go with the flow, and you move on to the next thing, and you sort of have these ideas, and when you were 4, it was appropriate that you had a 4-year-old's understanding of Sefer Bereishis, because you were 4 years old. But Bereishis wasn't only written for 4-year-olds, and Mishnayos was not only written for 9-year-olds. And it was also written for 9-year-olds, perhaps. But obviously, there's way more in Chumash Bereishis and way more in Seder Moed than a child could understand. So when one's a child, someone gets the child's understanding. That's great. But obviously, isn't there so much more to Shmoneh Esrei out there in Shmoneh Esrei than you could have understood the first time you davened? Of course there is. But naturally, if we just sort of go with the flow, you know, you could forever after have this sort of very childish understanding of the Yontif of Nesav Purma, childish understanding of Avram. You'll have a more mature understanding of Shor Shnag and Sapara, because you only start learning Bava Kama when you're 16 years old. So you'll have a 16-year-old's understanding of Bava Kama. Now, there's more than a 16-year-old can understand of that too. But at least we're up to 16. But Avram Avinu, it's time to refresh. So the way you do that, so that's the solution, is not to go with inertia. Solution is to actually learn, and not to, and to rethink. When Pesach comes around again, you're going to ask yourself, like, what does this mean? You're going to come to Rosh Hashanah, you're asking yourself questions as a 15, 16, 17, 19, 20-year-old that you wouldn't have asked 5 years ago, because you couldn't have asked 5 years because you didn't have the sophistication. So when you were 10 years old, yeah, apple and honey was a 10-year-old's understanding. But there's a lot more going on. I don't just mean the Gomagon about the connection to Chakal, Tapuch, and Kaddish. I mean, like, ask yourself the questions like, what does this mean? What does it do to Rosh Hashanah? Like, since when do doing things, it sounds magical. What does it mean? This is a good answer, very good answer. Post can work on, and meet Iri and others, and the Sivas. But it's a question you're going to ask that you wouldn't have had the sophistication to ask 5 years ago. That's how, in general, that's how a Jew grows. And so more, you want to grow into a more meaningful Jew, there's a connectedness between learning, particularly learning machshava, learning the meaningfulness of mitzvahs, learning the meaningfulness of ideas, and that feeding into a greater emotional appreciation, a greater mental understanding of the richness and the depth of our Torah, because our Torah is immensely sophisticated. It's a reflection of the wisdom of the infinite being. So there's way more. Anything we do is going to scratch the surface. But there's always more to scratch. There's always more to dig. Okay. That's a general plug for the importance of continuing to learn, continuing to try to understand ideas more deeply. One example is Yamim Tovim, and that is the solution to Hutner's problem. That's how it's going to be another Yontif gone in, instead of another Yontif gone by, is by learning. Is by, if when you come to Purim when you're 17, you come to Rosh Hashanah when you're 16 years old, and you're going to prepare in advance mentally, so then it's going to be a different spiritual experience, it'll be a different emotional experience. And the same is true for Happy Yom Tovim and for Shivas Batavos and Tishvah. If we see this time now, based on that story of Eliezer Zeira, as an opportunity, here's when we have a certain type of special access to Kadosh Baruch Hu we don't have on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, or Sukkot, or any other time of the year. An access that allows us to feel we're missing. So let's not let this opportunity go by. Let's understand what Mikdash is. Let's try to understand it more deeply. What is Beis Mikdash? It's more than just animals. Is that all that's missing? We lost the chance to shecht animals in the Beis Mikdash? Not necessarily something that resonates with us so much. Let's try to understand a little bit. I was... a picture is worth 1,000 words. I should have brought the picture along, and I'm not going to spend 1,000 words describing it. But I will tell you, I don't know what's on the agenda of trips this summer, but I took my kids last week to Mechon HaMikdash. It's an institute that's up the steps from the Kotel. And the Jews who have this idea that they want to prepare for Beis HaMikdash, basically hope Beis HaMikdash is going to come soon. We don't know when. We know it's going to happen. We don't know when. We hope soon. So they've tried as much as possible to do whatever a Jew can to build Kalim to get, they hope, will be used in the Beis HaMikdash. So, Al Pi Halacha, whether those Kalim will be used, won't be used, we'll find out when Mashiach comes. I don't know. But one thing I'll tell you for sure is when you go to Mechon HaMikdash, you get a much more real sense of like what a Beis HaMikdash could look like. And they even have a poster of Bayis HaShlishi sitting in an aerial view of modern Yerushalayim. It sort of makes it more real. Like Beis HaMikdash would actually be here. Like when you go to the Kotel, you stand on the way down, you say, like, we're going to bring the Paraduma over there on the Har HaZeisim. They'll be facing into the doorway of the Beis HaMikdash over there. All of a sudden, things become more real. So a real place. And what's going to happen in this real place? So our minds turn to Karbanos. And Karbanos are very important. Karbanos are very special, but it's much more than Karbanos. And I want to share with you a mystery. And the mystery is the mystery of the lost ark. Raiders. The Lost Ark, right? Where is? Well, what's that all about? That's fiction, but it is based in reality. The reality is, one thing we know for sure is when the Kohen Gadol went into Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the second Beis HaMikdash, he never, for those 400 some odd years, he never, ever, ever saw the Aron. All the Kohen Gadol, of course, the entire Bayi Sheni, never saw the Aron. They would walk in this big slab of stone, and they would say to themselves, there used to be an Aron here a couple hundred years ago, and they would sprinkle the blood in that direction towards the stone where the Aron had been in the Bayis Rishon. So where's the Aron? That's a good question. Where is the Aron? So the Gemara in Yuma says, well, Machlokas HaTanon. One Tana says, Nebuchadnezzar, you know why it's not in the second Beis HaMikdash? Because when they sacked the first one, they took everything. There's a big beautiful golden box with golden sculptures. Of course they took it. Nebuchadnezzar came in, Nebuchadnezzar came in. The Bavli armies come in, destroy the first Beis HaMikdash, and they took away all the valuable things, including the Aron. So the first opinion is, where is the Aron? It's in some museum in Iraq. In Babel. Iraq is Babel. So they took it to Iraq, and who knows where it is now? Who knows? The other option, the Gemara says, is no, the Aron never left Yerushalayim. The Aron never left Har HaBayis. The other option is that a couple of decades before the Beis HaMikdash was sacked by the Bavlim, they knew, it was clear that things were out. And the Nevi'im were telling them, and those willing to listen to the Nevi'im saw. Other Amoris, the other Tanna says that the last great Jewish king, Yoshiyahu HaMelech, who led the Tshuva movement, unfortunately was not enough to stave off destruction of Beis HaMikdash entirely. But he was the last really powerful king of Babel. After him, they were all puppets. His children, grandchildren were kings of Yerushalayim, but they were all puppet kings of this or that superpower. The last really sovereign king, Yoshiyahu HaMelech, he saw what was coming, he knew what he had to do, and Shlomo HaMelech had built subterranean chambers below Beis HaMikdash. Century, when he built Beis HaMikdash originally, there was a sub-basement, and Yoshiyahu said, now's the time to use it. And he had them remove the Aron from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, put it in the basement, and there it stays forever. And that way, when the Nebuchadnezzar came, there was no Aron to take, because it had already disappeared into the basement. So that's the Machlokas and Maseches Yuma Daf and Gimel. Machlokas, I believe, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, maybe Asher will correct me, if from memory from the computer. Machlokas HaTana, where is the Aron? Was it taken to Iraq? Aron Gol above it? Did it go into Golos? Or no? B'mekomo Nignaz, it was hidden under in the sub-basement of the Beis HaMikdash. Interesting machlokas. Machlokas, I interpret the psukim. A historical machlokas. What happened over 2,000 years ago during the final decades of the first Beis HaMikdash? Interesting historical question. Strangely, though, there's a halachic work that paskins this non-halachic question. The Rambam, in his halachas of Beis HaMikdash, when he talks in the beginning of the fourth chapter of the halachas of Beis HaBechir, when he talks about the different levels of Kedusha in Beis HaMikdash, begins by saying, there used to be an Aron in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and then at the end of the Bayis Rishon, Yoshiyahu took it and buried it, and the chambers were there from the beginning. Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash with a sub-basement, and Yoshiyahu put in the sub-basement, and there lies the Ari Yomazeh. So the Mepharshim say, several Mepharshim say, it's an interesting question, but it's not a halacha, it's a historical question, a fascinating historical question. Either it was taken, if Yoshiyahu hid it, or else Nebuchadnezzar took it. What happened? Machlokas HaTanaim, how to read the psukim. But how do you paskin on a historical question? Either it was or it wasn't. But it doesn't belong in the halacha sefer. Unless it's halacha. Why is it halacha? So both Yaakov Emden and the Rav Soloveitchik raise the same question and give the same answer in remarkably similar terminology. And they say something incredibly important. They say it's not just a question of history. When we say we paskin that the Aron is under Kodesh HaKadoshim, that means not just it happens to be that, oh, our sentimental Aron, we have sentimental attachment to Aron, Baruch Hashem, it's in safe hands. Much more than that. It's that we paskin that it's there, and it's a good thing that it's there, because if it wasn't there, it wouldn't be a Beis HaMikdash any longer. We paskin that the reason why it's down there is because you can't have a Beis HaMikdash without an Aron. You can't have Beis HaMikdash without Luchos. That perhaps also explains why it is the Rambam seems to say that Luchos are not a part, the Aron is not a part of the Beis HaMikdash, like the other Kalim, like the menorah, the Mizbech, there were furniture for the Beis HaMikdash. The Aron perhaps instead is the foundation of Beis HaMikdash, because you can't have a Beis HaMikdash without first having an Aron there, without first having Luchos. Beautiful. But that just begs the question. Well, why? Why can't you have, if you went to your Nevi'im Rishonim, you know that with an Aron it's more of a Mikdash, without an Aron it's a much lower type of a Bama. But why? I mean, if Beis HaMikdash is all about bringing Karbanos, so then you never see the Aron. Who sees the Aron? One Jew sees the Aron for a couple of minutes a year. So what do you need the Aron for? the answer? The answer is no, because Kedusha is sourced in Torah. Kedusha means the closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Say in the Davin, Rav Shechter points out in a beautiful article in Eretz Tzvi, Ata Kadosh V'Shimcha Kadosh. Ribbono Shel Olam is holy, HaKadoshim V'Chayim Rekuch, Ribbono Shel Olam is holy, and then we tried to plug into holiness by connecting ourselves with Ribbono Shel Olam. But ultimately, Kedusha, the source of Kedusha is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the avenue, the primary channel through which Kedusha flows into this world is through HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. And Rav Shechter put together several drashas of the Rav, which together point out that almost every type of Kedusha in our lives is rooted in Torah. Kedusha of a Jew is rooted in Torah. When items have Kedusha, those learned in the fourth paragraph of Megillah, those items are used for mitzvahs but don't connect to Torah, like shofar and sukkah and lulav, during the mitzvah, they have the Kedusha. Once the mitzvah is over, sukkah is over, you neatly, politely put the esrog in the garbage or eat it. Whatever. It has no, you don't have to bury it. Strictly speaking, you don't have to bury tzitzis. You can't put the tzitzis in a disgraceful way with the smelly kitchen garbage. You can put it in a neat office garbage, or you can wrap it in a bag and put it in the garbage. It doesn't have to go into Sheamus. But something that has Torah in it, tefillin, mezuzah, svarim, that has to go into Geniza. Because Torah is what creates a permanent Kedusha. And the greatest expression of Torah was in the Beis HaMikdash. Both because the Sanhedrin, which was the center of Torah Shabbat Peh, met in the Beis HaMikdash. They met not far from the Mizbech. It's a remarkable thing. The Mizbech is over there. It's bloody. It's gory. There are live animals and dead animals and blood on the Mizbech. And a few steps away, 71 top Talmid Chachamim in the world are adjudicating court cases. To us it seems like those are such different things. But they're not. Beis HaMikdash was a center of Torah, of Torah Shebaal Peh, as evidenced by the presence of Sanhedrin. It's a center of Torah Shebaal Sa'ah. For example, not the only example, but for example, the author's original copy, the two sets of Luchos in the Aron, had to be in the Beis HaMikdash. That's what powered the Beis HaMikdash. Without that, the lights were off. Without that, there was no Kedusha. It was a center of connectedness, a center of connectedness to Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a very different picture. And it's for that, the Karbanos are a consequence of that. If this is a place where a Jew can come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, empowered by those Luchos, and further empowered by the presence of Sanhedrin, so then a lot of things are going to fall into place. And that's why to this very day, we daven, we face out of Eretz Yisrael, we face towards Eretz Yisrael. But here we're facing Yerushalayim. I was at the Kotel last week, Davi Mincha. So everyone's facing, which way do you face the Kotel? That's a silly question, you face the Kotel, right? Well, they actually were, those who've been with me, there are some, it was reminiscent of some Batei, certain Batei Medrash. There were most people facing straight the Kotel, and there are some people, the Chazan was facing to the side. Why? Not because there's a Chashim going to Kabbalah Chazan over there, but because that's where the Aron is. Because the Aron isn't straight ahead, the Aron is to the side. Because ultimately, that's the power source. But that's the power source for our tefillos all over the world. Because the greatest place to daven would be on Har Bayis itself, in Beis HaMikdash itself. Why? Daven, what is daven to? Why is it better shul? The answer is, Beis HaMikdash wasn't just a place of karbanos. Beis HaMikdash was a place where a Jew could naturally, we spoke before, we're close where we began. We spoke about different climates, temporal climates, climates in time throughout the Jewish calendar. And we've been spending time thinking about what it is at this period of time, these 3 weeks, what opportunity they give us to plug in with greatest access to plug into HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a way that we'll feel what we're missing, we'll feel what could have been. Our relationship got not cut off, Chas V'Shalom, but certainly cut down, because we don't have the place we used to have to meet. Even now, the best place to daven is via Mikdash. But imagine what it was like when it was fully operational, when we were able to experience such easy closeness, easy access, you just pick up the phone and call, you could just stop in. That's what you could stop in there for learning, for daven, for chesed, for karbanos. It was the center of of easy easier access to Kadosh Baruch Hu. And now the office door is locked. You know, the pediatrician has office hours. So during office hours, you have a problem, you have a sore throat, you think you have strep, you just go to the office and they'll take you. Maybe you have to wait a little bit, they'll fit you and they'll take you. But if the office is closed, it's 2 a.m, you wake up with a terrible earache, you get an ear infection, it's going to be a lot harder. You're going to get through to the pediatrician, but it's going to be a lot harder because the office isn't open. You'll have to reach him by phone, and then you'll call the service, and they'll call back, right? You can get to him, but it's not the same access. The office was open for hundreds of years, and then it was closed for 70 years. Then it was open again for hundreds of years, and the office, Ribbono Shel Olam's office in this world has been closed for the last 2,000 years. That's what we're missing. And all of the different aspects of our Judaism were richer and deeper and fuller and more colorful when we had Beis HaMikdash because God's office was open for everything, for Karban, for learning, for Davin, Yontif, every Yontif was totally different. Sukkot was totally different. Pesach was totally different. Everything was totally different. It was so multidimensional. That's what we're missing. As you learn about what happened on Sukkot in Beis HaMikdash that we don't have access to, what happened with Karban Pesach, with the Karban HaOmer, and in Shavuos, so much, every aspect of our Yadus was and will be richer when Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. When the office is open, so everything can happen. The strep test, is anything you need from the pediatrician is easier to get to, whether you need a test, you need to be looked at, you need records, you want a conversation. If, when the office is open, you have whatever access you need to him, all the different dimensions. And that's what we, over the next couple of next 3 weeks, we think about and learn about. It's a good idea to learn in the next 3 weeks of what things look like in Beis HaMikdash. Learn Mishnayos Tamid. You get a sense of what it was like in Beis HaMikdash. And yet, the different aspects of what it was like in Beis HaMikdash, to appreciate what it means for Ribbono Shel Olam's office to be open and how that could radically transform every angle of our Avodas Hashem through having greater, easier access. The more we work on that, the more we can appreciate what we had, what we will have in return when Beis HaMikdash will be built, the more one feels, I really am missing something. To come to a, to the, over the course of 3 weeks, we have to feel, yeah, I'm really missing. I wish I had that access. I wish the office was open. The more we use this time, when it's easiest to, when you don't have to be Eliezer Ze'ira to wear those shoes. You don't have to be a great Talmid. Every Jew can plug into that. We use this time well. We hope that certainly we'll come to appreciate what we had. We'll come to appreciate what we will have. And we hope that through the greater yearning that we will have, that day will come ever soon when we can actually see what it is in our lifetimes, in our backyard, to have Beis HaMikdash, b'mehayah v'yameinu.